think this was a quick introduction. I was not really prepared. So yeah, the topic is how do pulsars shine. So the main goal would be to understand some peculiar features of pulsar emission mechanisms throughout the electromagnetic spectrum. I've done my thesis with Anatoly Spetkovsky in Princeton, and definitely a couple of more people contributed to this research. So I'll start from the introduction. Like the pulsar is a small neutron star, 10 kilometer size, a solar mass object spinning at periods of 1 second and less, very tiny, very fastly spinning. And there is a huge magnetic field around the neutron star, around 10 to 12 Gauss. And the basic physical phenomena which happens is that when you spin a conductor in magnetic field, you start to generate electric fields. And when this electric field points along the magnetic field, it starts to pull out charges, electrons and ions from the atmosphere of the neutron star. So you get this first particle dragged by the electric field, which points along the magnetic field from the neutron star surface. They start to populate the surrounding. And moreover, what happens here is that these particles become accelerated to high energies in this electric field. They travel along curved magnetic field lines. So they experience acceleration to the local point of curvature. So they emit photons, which we call curvature photons. They're around GeV energies around surface of the of this neutron stars, and these GeV photons in 10 to 12 Gauss magnetic field, they're depleted into electron-positron pair. And the secondary pair starts also to be accelerated by the same electric field. If electrons are accelerated out, the positrons would be accelerated back to the star. It again emits this curvature photons. They're also, when they're produced, they're at non-zero Landau level. So they, in this very high magnetic field, they're quickly dragged into zeros level, emitting a bunch of synchrotron photons. So you get both synchrotron and curvature photons in this high field. They're depleted. You get more pairs. And this is an avalanche process, which is thought to populate the surroundings of this neutron star, which we call a magnetosphere. So everything around the neutron star I'll call a magnetosphere. It's not a vacuum, it's filled with this plasma. It's still, though the density is significant to back react on this electromagnetic fields. So these charges, they drive charge densities, currents. They would feed back on this initially dipolar magnetic field structure. But the densities are low in a sense that the mean free path to Coulomb collisions of these particles is way larger than the system size. So from the plasma physics point of view, it's a very cool problem. You have collisionless plasma. You have all this QED effects. You're also living near the neutron star. So the space-time is distorted by the GR effect. So you need to understand both GR, QED, and usual plasma physics. It's a collisionless plasma, the most like fundamental object of plasma physics. And then we observe the sources across the whole electromagnetic band. They were discovered 50 years ago in radio. Then they were observed in optical X-rays. And most recently, with the launch of Fermi Space Telescope, the knowledge about gamma-ray emitting pulsars exploded. So we knew like three pulsars before Fermi. Now we know a couple of hundreds. And those gamma rays provided a very important window into knowledge of how these magnetospheres really operate. And to know how they emit and how to match this observed large phenomenology, you need physical models. So this is a summary about, like, let's say, open questions about the sources. To produce this radiation that you see, you need to accelerate particles. So you need to know where particles are accelerated, to what energies. And you need to understand the mechanisms at which they emit this radiation. For that, you definitely need to know how the global machine operates. So you need to know the conditions everywhere in this magnetosphere. And for that, we have a clue that we kind of know how much plasma we have in these magnetospheres, because when this, what we call pulsar wind, a flow of electromagnetic field and particles reach the ISM, it produces a shock and what we call a pulsar wind nebulae. So this wind nebulae emits synchrotron radiation, and we can convert this amount of radiation into number of particles. And this
is that composed of stars? What is it composed of?
No, it's a surrounding of this, let's say, termination shock, right? So the wind touches the ISM, it creates a shock, and then it also accelerates particles. Yes, it's called a wind nebulae.
A
wind pulsar wind nebulae.
And it's emitting radio, optical?
Yes, it's mostly emitting radio, but all other bands as well. Recently, they were discovered in gamma rays also. So there are many, many questions about nebula itself. But for our purposes, it's reasonable to know that the amount of particles in this nebulae, and they all come from the central source, from the pulsar, they match with what I told on the previous slide. The density is sufficient to significantly influence the electromagnetic fields around the star. And the last, maybe not the question I'll not cover, but if you want to ask me, so how pulsars evolve in time. So this electromagnetic structure around the star, it feedbacks on the central star. It carries energy and momentum away, so the central star spins down. It's very important to understand how they evolve in time to understand the population of the sources. So this is a cartoon picture which was introduced back in 69 by Pichel, Goljak, and Julian. Their idea was that you only extract particles from the central star. They did not elaborate this QED process that I told about. It came in a few years after that. So they thought about this electrons from the neutron star extracted and driving a current by just a charge-separated flow, only electrons flying outwards creating this current. So this current you can think of as a wire. A wire creates a toroidal field around it, which is shown as these dots. And then you also produce electric field because in order to screen this vacuum potential drops that I told in the beginning, you need certain charge density, which minimal charge density that you need, which is just a divergence of V cross B. So if you want to screen all electric fields around your you'll produce what we call a corrotation electric field. Electric field equals to minus rotational speed cross B. And it happens that in dipolar field, the divergence of that is not zero. And this is the charge density that you need, what we now call the Goldrich and Julian charge density, just angular velocity of the star dot the magnetic field. So this is a minimal charge density that you put into this magnetospheres from central sources. The electric field corresponding to this charge density would be along the theta direction. So you'll get theta electric field, toroidal magnetic field. This produces a radial pointing flux. So this electromagnetic field carries energy away from the star. And this current should close somewhere on the star. It closes on this region, which we call a polar cap, a 100-meter size region, like a football stadium. Which carries all this important phenomena about accelerating particles, producing pairs, and emitting this wind. So at this 100-meter object, this like size, this current should close up. So the circuit should be closed. So when the current is closed, it flows across the magnetic field in theta direction, and J cross B force, the usual Lorentz force, implies a torque on a star, and this is the torque which spins the pulsar down.
So in the picture, you're not showing it closing? I mean, this current just coming out, but there
right,
must return in some way.
Yeah, this would be Goldrich and Julian did not put much attention about this. So this would be an actual problem with their model. So the returning, I'll talk in glory details. So this is just a cartoon picture. You extract current, you drive it outwards, you imply torque on the star, and this is the minimal charge density that you need to create that. It took actually 40 years to provide a quantitative paradigm for that picture, at least in the zeros detail. So the zeros detail picture is that you have your plasma motion equation, like the Lorentz force equals to inertia velocity dt, just acceleration, plus some pressure terms. This is just the momentum equation from Navier-Stokes. And you assume that the density in energy density in the electromagnetic field is so much that you can ignore all those things. So in 10 to 12 Gauss field, it fully controls the motion of plasma. You can forget about the back reaction of plasma about it. And also you screen all electric field along the magnetic field. That's what usually plasma does. It wants to kill acceleration by first place. So what it does is just that if you try and force some electric field, it would create a charge separation. Opposite charges would drift in opposite way and create an electric field in the opposite direction. So the net field would be reduced. If you have a net like sufficient amount of charges, you'll kill all this accelerating electric field. So from these two assumptions, you can calculate actually the current. So from this equation, you see that current is charge density cross B plus some current along the field. And this current along the field, which is written here, you can evolve from Maxwell's equations in this condition. So what you get, a system which completely ignores everything about plasma. Your current is only a spatial function of electric and magnetic field. So you can plug it back to Maxwell's equations. And this is a pretty good system to try on a computer. You have time derivative equal to spatial derivative, and the same here. So the usual Maxwell's equations in flat space-time. So the first result was about the axisymmetric magnetosphere. The original result was back from 99. So what happens here is that here the black lines are the poloidal field lines, the field lines in this particular plane where the magnetic and rotational axis are in plane. And the color is a toroidal field. So what you see here is that some field lines are still closed near the star. Some fields opened up, as Goldrich and Julian thought about. You drive a current along these field lines, which creates this toroidal field. This toroidal field is opposite in two hemispheres, just because the current direction is different. And then they meet here and create what we call a current sheet, a discontinuity where you need to support the flip in this toroidal field. And if you look into the current closure, as Neil asked, so there is a current that goes out and current which goes back, and the closure happens at this separatrix, which we call a tiny region at the interface of this closed region. So there, the toroidal field also experience a drop. There is no net toroidal field here and a strong field here. So in the interface, there should be a current. And this is this current that closes the circuit.
Is it actually singular or on that surface?
In this paradigm, it's singular.
Right.
Because you neglected everything about plasma.
Sure.
Sorry, can you recall what you call the toroidal field?
The field out of plane. So like you put a wire, it creates this kind of field, the toroidal field. The current flows like this here. The current is in toroidal in that direction, which I call toroidal, and it's out of plane. So yeah, features that you create this Y point where the current switches into this separatrix. There is a peculiar surface, which is the curvatation surface, the surface at which you want to curvate with the star. And at some distance, it will become a speed of light, because the curvatational speed is just omega r. So at some distance, it will become speed of light. And this we call a light cylinder. So earlier research was thinking there is some pathology at the surface, that something will break out. In fact, nothing breaks out, because the plasma motion is mostly radial there. The toroidal motion is negligible. So most of plasma just leaves along those open field lines. There is no pathology. And it becomes like a split monopole. The field lines became radial. And along this radial field lines, you have a current, so they are balanced by this toroidal field. So this is the zero solder picture. Real pulsars are oblique rotators. Their magnetic and rotational axes are misaligned. You see them only when the magnetic axis points towards you once per period, the lighthouse effect. If they were aligned, you'll either see it all the time, because the magnetic axis would be at all points pointing towards you, or you'll not see at all. We see both kinds of things, but this is the most common thing about observed pulsars. So it was generalized to oblique rotators in late 2000s. So topologically, you'll still find similar thing. You have closed field lines, you have open field lines, you have the current sheet. The current sheet shape is now peculiar. It's not this nice equatorial line or a disk in 3D, as I pointed before. It's an undulating structure, but topologically it's similar. You have this current which flies out, you have this jump at this rotating interface. And pretty much everything is the same intuitively. So again, no pathologies. You can calculate the spin down, the actual amount of energy which this pointing flux wind gets outwards from the star as a function of this inclination angle, the angle between magnetic and rotational axis. You can quantify it. So it turns out that the losses of the pulsar increase with the inclination angle. And the reason for that was actually pretty similar. You just bunch up the field towards the equator. More flux goes at the equator, and at that point it contributes more to the energy flux, because all your electric and magnetic fields are to zero, so they're just a function of the rotation. Rotation is stronger at the equator. If you put more flux toward the equator, you'll increase the spin down losses. So this is this 50% effect difference between zeros and 90 degrees inclination angle.
The pointing flux represents energy, which is
yes.
Where is it deposited, this energy? Is it in the nebulae?
It's a good question. So there is what we call a sigma problem. When we try to model the morphology of the nebulae, it has to be low magnetized. It has to be most of the energy going into particles. So at some point, this wind energy, which is purely electromagnetically dominated, should bump into particles. How it happens is still uncertain. We have clues about that this region bounded by this current sheet is actually does converting energy from electromagnetic field into particles. Because of magnetic reconnection, which I will describe in details afterwards, the wind region, the field lines which actually go away, they don't touch the current sheet, is much less certain. But people start to do three-dimensional modeling of this nebula as well. They start to do instabilities which were not predicted before. So I think it would be sold out.
So for the spin-down, so just magnetic dipole radiation, what would I get from just a pure magnetic dipole?
Right, so the pure magnetic dipole radiation, you will be qualitatively right. Quantitatively, you will be wrong by 200%. And the reason is completely different. You don't have a vacuum wave here. You have a plasma flow with electromagnetic field. It's completely different to just vacuum wave driving outwards.
And if it is aligned, you have no radiation at all.
Yes, and you're aligned, your vacuum radiation doesn't work, but there is still spin down because you have this currents which close at the polar region.
But all these plasma considerations only apply to the Big Young 10 to the 12 gas pulsars, or does this change substantially when you think about older pulsars with
That have 10 to 8 gauss field? Good question. There are other channels of pair creation. There is inverse Compton, let's say. You accelerate particles, you have photons from the hot neutron star surface, you Compton upscatter them to sufficient energies, and then you do two photon collisions. You'll not produce pairs because you have one photon splinting into the B field, but you have two photons. They collide and create pairs. So millisecond pulsars are still thought to produce these dense flows because we see radio emission from them. And the radio emission is definitely associated with this dense plasma flow. And they're all similar. There is no much difference between millisecond pulsars and old pulsars, and young pulsars, sorry.
Symmetric case you showed first, if I go into the frame that's rotating when the pulsar, the solution is just stationary, is that right?
In this case, you...
In the first axisymmetric case, it was
stationary. I mean, it's stationary in all frames.
And then in this case?
In this case, if you jump into a frame which co-rotates with you, so the magnetic axis is rotating around the rotation axis, if you jump into a frame where magnetic axis is stationary, you'll see a steady state. And actually, I'll show more plots of that in a steady frame.
Oh, so you mean, but that's a different frame than the one that rotates with the pulsar.
Yes, it's not a Lorentz transformation into a frame which co-rotates, because at some point it breaks out. You cannot co-rotate faster than the speed of light. It's just kinematics. You say you jump into a frame phi prime equals to phi minus omega t, and then that frame is stationary. So this was all fun. We understood the large-scale geometry of the magnetic field, but we could not answer several important questions. For example, we forgot everything about plasma particles. We just saw the dynamics of the electromagnetic field. To understand how non-thermal emission is produced, you need to understand how particles are accelerated. So all these two effects were missed in the MHD approach. You need to recover it back. And you also cannot answer the most theoretically interesting question is, are those solutions unique? We postulated the plasma everywhere around the neutron star. Does it happen everywhere, or there are these vacuum gaps which some people claimed are interesting for accelerating particles, or something else happens? So to understand all of this, you need a more fundamental approach. And the more fundamental approach is to model the plasma system from first principles. So the core of this research is using the codes which were used for studying collisionless plasma in the laboratory and recently in astrophysics, what we call particle and cell model. So the idea here is that you have your computational grid. At each grid point, you have electromagnetic components of the field, E and B. And then you have macro particles flying around. Their dynamics is governed by the Lorentz force equation. D momentum dt is equals to Lorentz force. And then from the collection of these particles, you can extrapolate the current just by summing up the contribution from different particles. This charge and current density are then sources for the Maxwell's equations, which help you to define electromagnetic field and new time step. And then this loop continues. So this is the zeroth order idea of how things work. And to simulate pulsars, you need many improvements. You need this conducting star boundary condition, which we model as an atmosphere of charges lying on top of the real conductor, which produces these charges which can be extracted outwards. The radiative cooling is important because the charges emit high-frequency radiation that you actually not capture on your grid. So you need to take care of that radiation, and we just imply a drag force on the particles. This is just the Larmor formula for the emission of charges in varying electromagnetic fields. So if, let's say, a charge is sitting on a circle with a magnetic field like this, and charge is doing circle around it, it would emit synchrotron radiation, and this would be this drag. This is just the intensity of the synchrotron radiation that the particle emits, and it's pointing into the direction that the reduced particle's energy. So it's an analytical formula, no problem doing this. You need to also do the pair creation stuff, and we came up with different...
G means the drag acceleration.
Drag force. Right. So when particles accelerate, they emit radiation, they lose energy, and this is a drag force at all particle influence. So pair production, we model all the sources of pairs. We model both pair production in this high magnetic field and also in photon collisions. Most recently, we've been doing tracking of photons, doing this non-local pair production, very sophisticated. You need to also include effects of GR. So we are doing Maxwell's equations in slowly rotating metric. I'll tell later why it's important. And this just summarizes how we need to trade off between the reality and being like able to simulate things. In reality, this is a neutron star radius, 10 kilometers. This is a fundamental length in plasma physics, the skin depth, the C divided by the plasma frequency. In reality, this is centimeters, this is 10 kilometers, so a huge separation of scales. We need to bring them down a little. So what we can simulate now in three dimensions is like 30, 40. Like up to 50 maybe, in two dimensions we can go up to several hundred. So this is still a large number allowing sufficient scale separation. Another parameter, the size of this magnetosphere I described before, the light cylinder is 100 kilometers for Crab, and this is 10 kilometers, so the ratio is more than 1,000. So in 3D we can model like 5 up to 10. In 2D we went up to like several tens. So there are not many features that change in the solution, but we need to understand like what's the boundary of the approach is. The typical potential drop or the typical energy that the particle can gain in the acceleration in this electromagnetic fields, I told you, you have GeV photons from these particles. So the typical Lorentz factor is about 10 to 5. We've been modeling something about a few hundreds up to 1,000. So again, what you need numerically is to support a sufficient scale separation. Once it reaches a certain limit, it should be scale-free, more or less.
So I'm sure what knob do you use for the last one? Is it the
frankly, make a big deal.
Sorry?
What knob do you use to go to threshold 40, just the strength of the magnetic field?
Oh, the threshold. The threshold is the energy at which you start to pair produce near the star. So near the star, it's only just the Lorentz factor of the particle that matters. You don't need to wait to a second photon from outside to produce a second photon. You just accelerate to sufficient energies. You think that you emit curvature photon, and it's going to be depleted into a pair. So we drop that process because the mean free pass is small compared to everything. So you just say the energy is sufficient. You start producing secondaries.
What is the question about how you've implemented cooling? So. So this looks like cooling from synchrotron. Is this properly captured, the catastrophic synchrotron cooling, or the impact from the curvature?
Yes, good question. I can tell you in glory details. But the fact is, the zeroth order fact is that when the particle drifts in the curvature field, it experiences a curvature drift. So if you plug in the velocity of the curvature drift in this formula, you'll get the losses of curvature radiation. And you need this term, which is non-relativistic. You'll look at this, you'll tell me gamma squared here, nothing here. Your gamma is large, why are you caring about this? But in the direction of that curvature drift, actually what's most important is this term. So this term determines the change of the curvature drift when you're slowing down by emitting this radiation. And this updating curvature drift enters into this second equation and defines you the correct losses. So it captures both curvature and synchrotron radiation in one formula. And you don't need to calculate the non-local thing like a curvature. All things are local here. So computationally, very much simpler than doing non-local things.
So since GR is going to be important and you're imposing this kind of artificial hierarchy of scales that's far from the physical case, I mean, in some sense, how do you control for...
The GR is important only where near the surface. So you can assume that it's only important where this acceleration happens. And acceleration happens very close to the star at the skin-depth scale. So in a sense that you can think of the scale of GR as being the same scale as the radius of the star. So it's mostly the same scale. It doesn't introduce you a new scale. So this is just to tell what comes next is you can think of different regimes in this complicated problem. You can try what Goldreich and Jurian thought about, just this particle escape from the surface without any pair production. And we saw unexpected, I'll say, results out of it. Then you can say you have this free particle escape, but forget about all this complicated business and just, let's say, jump a lot of particles into this magnetosphere and see how it back reacts on itself. And then we'll do more realistic things, which I'll describe later. So the first thing that you tried actually doesn't work like Peter Goldreich thought. So these are the solutions that you find by just extracting particles from the neutron star surface. What it does, it creates this peculiar charge-separated solutions. So these white things are electrons. These orange dots are ions. Here they're greenish. This is a line solution. This is a solution with an inclination angle of 30 degrees. There is no flow of particles to infinity. They're all trapped near the surface. And yeah, if you actually talk to people in the lab, they will tell you, oh, you know, it's perfectly reasonable. What happens is that first charges, they all just leave the system to infinity and leave a net charge on this neutron star. So the next electron that comes out, first it feels this induction electric field from spinning the conductor in magnetic fields, which drives electron outwards. But at larger distances, it starts to feel the charge of the central star. So they're bouncing back and forth in this region by not being able to escape. So you have trapped electrons, trapped ions. There is no outflow and spin down in the line case. And this oblique solution that only drives this vacuum electromagnetic wave outwards. There is no plasma flow to infinity which can modify the field structure. So earlier studies thought that there can be a drawback in this logic, is that this equatorial flow of ions it's moving differentially. So if you'll just measure the rotational velocity of these charges in this equator, you'll see they're differentially rotating with different speeds. And when the fluid or flow of charges rotate differentially, you can expect instabilities. Like in pure hydro, this would be a Kellen-Helmholtz instability. Here it's more complicated. This is called diachatron instability, also coming from some lab experiments. So what happens is that you create charge modulations in this equatorial disk, which actually allows some charges to leave to infinity. So you create like spiral arms of charges leaving. But if you simulate this carefully long enough, you find that the net current that flies outwards in these electrons is tiny. It's not sufficient to drive the circuit that was described by MHD studies and the Goldreich's paper. So essentially, this solution is dead. It's only creating these trapped charges around, not producing anything interesting. So this is how I think the oldest dead neutron stars in the universe, which don't emit anything, just sitting there, they all look like this. Then you ask, like, what happens if I'll put enough charges in this magnetosphere? This should look like what MHD told us, because in MHD, we assume that there are lots of charges. They are sufficient to drive these dynamics. And indeed, this is kind of what happens. There are lots of charges around here. And what you find that this closed field region, open field light region, toroidal field of opposite direction meeting in this equatorial region. So you create this Karen sheet beyond the light cylinder. And an advantage of this solution compared to MHD is that the dynamics of plasma instabilities, which happen in this region where you bring two opposite magnetic fluxes together, at some point you break MHD because your magnetic field goes through zero and some plasma physics should kick in. So from isolated studies of these Karen sheets, like regardless of the global structure, we know that they're unstable to several instabilities. And here you can see that the sheet is actually wiggling around a little bit. So when it forms, it does something like this. So the current flows like this. There is a perpendicular displacement of the current, which makes it unstable. This is what's called the drift kink instability. So it's undulating across the direction of the current. And I'll describe this, the most important second instability later. But now what's important is that the particles are actually accelerated in this region where two opposite fields meet each other. Because when you bring two opposite fields together, they should release this magnetic field energy into something. And this something in self-consistent picture should be energy of particles. So the particles are energized up to a level where their energy becomes comparable to the magnetic field energy. So you release all that energy in this current sheet. This is going to be important for modeling of gamma rays. And this is a three-dimensional structure of the solution. The red lines are field lines. This color thing is the energy of the particles, the Lorentz factor. So you see that most energization of particles happen in the equatorial region beyond the light cylinder. So the light cylinder here is the region where the closed magnetosphere ends up. So beyond that, you have only this reconnecting current sheet with accelerated particles. So it was a nice experiment, but again, the reality is more complicated. You have this global thing. The plasma is not introduced by hand. It's controlled by this pair production region, which happens on the tiniest scale in your problem, the scale where plasma physics effects are important. This region provides you charge carriers, which drive these currents, charge densities. They feed back on the magnetospheric structure, which leaves on large scale, on scales of the light cylinder. And then this structure defines you the distribution in this discharge zone. So everything is coupled. You cannot just zoom in on your particular region of interest, studying that in glory details with an isolation from the global picture. The global picture should be taken into account all these sources of plasma and how they're accelerated. And if you start to do the simplest thing, the aligned rotator with this more self-consistent pair production, what you find is, again, as a surprising thing, is that this polar outflow that I described to you, that you get the electrons accelerated producing pairs, you don't find this. You find electrons flowing at non-relativistic velocities to infinity, and not producing any positrons. So what's wrong here is electrons and positrons. These black lines are poloidal field lines. So in this polar region where you expect to get acceleration, you only get electrons. And that's why you don't get positrons. Electrons are accelerated to only moderate energies. And the reason for this is this global structure. This global structure wants the current density, which flows in this region, to be less than the charge density times C. If the current is less than the charge density times C, you can provide this current just by one sign of charge flying with a non-relativistic velocity current divided by the charge density. And this current turned out to be sufficient to drive this large-scale MHD structure, more or less, and electrons are not accelerated. So it's just that the global geometry tells you what the velocity of electrons should be in that particular region. And this solution has now been confirmed. It's been shown in axis symmetry. So this is a paper from a Columbia group. They have also electrons and positrons shown. You have electrons escaping, no positrons flies out. There is still pair production in this boundary between the separatrix and the Oppold field line region, this region here and here. And there is also pair production in the current sheet beyond the light cylinder, so this is an active circuit still. But there is no polar discharge in this region, so only electrons, no positrons. And this is peculiar for radio emission purposes, because observationally we definitely know that radio emission from pulsars come from this region where the discharge happens. We know geometrically how large the emission size is, and it's very well confined by this region of open field lines. So there should be a discharge there, and we do see mostly aligned pulsars. So some physics is missed here. They use an axis symmetric code. It's mostly of the same capabilities. They're also modeling pair production. It's also.
So the ingredients are the same.
Yes, yes.
So what's your guess as to what's missing in terms of explaining radio?
Just wait 5 minutes.
Oh, okay.
As I described before, real pulsars are oblique, so you think most of pulsars. So you think if you would go to higher inclination, you'll get this pair production region back. But what happened if you even simulate 60 degrees, you find that here you have both selections and positrons, but here you only get only electrons back. So it solves a part of the problem, but not fully. So you get some of these discharging regions, but not over the full polar cap. And if you're before 40 degrees, you're mostly aligned. So the global structure looks more like an aligned rotator, no pair formation at all. So in these regions where pair production does happen, the current is larger than the charge density times C. In a relativistic language, you can call it space-like. So when the current is space-like, it can't be supported by the flow of charges of one sign. It needs a second sign of charge. And the second sign of charge comes from these discharge regions, and they provide this large current flow which the global magnetosphere wants. I think I can talk a bit about this instability. So the current sheet again starts to be undulating around its mean direction. So this is a drift kink instability across the current field direction. In the perpendicular plane, if you look into the distribution of particle density, you start to see that this current sheet becomes to be bounded into this overdense regions. And this is what we call a tearing instability. So initially, laminar current sheet with the field line in plane starts to produce this blobs of plasma where magnetic fields is actually going in a circle. So there are circles of magnetic fields inside the current sheet separated by the region where magnetic field actually goes through zero. This is what we call X points. And in these X points, which are extended regions here, I show in green. So these regions are coincided by these blobs where magnetic fields is in circles. Here you have X regions. And in this X regions, the electric field actually exceeds the magnetic field because the magnetic field goes through zero. Where electric field exceeds magnetic field, you definitely expect particle acceleration. Like in any frame, you have just electric field that should boost particles to high energies. And this is what indeed happens in the sources. You have these particles, they go through this X point, they're accelerated to high energies. And what I later show is that when these particles are advected into these regions of higher field, they emit synchrotron radiation. And the synchrotron radiation is what we see as gamma rays from pulsars. So this is like a jump to later.
So what determines this, the number of these X points?
This is an aspect ratio of the sheet. So if you do more and more elongated Karen sheet, it starts to fragment more and more efficiently. So the more detailed picture here is that you start from initial sheet, it breaks into chunks of islands which is determined by your box size. But then this secondary islands, they become to be extracted by the large by the magnetic stresses, and the secondary Karen sheet also becomes unstable. So the number of actual plasmoids is determined by the separation of scales of this width and the Karen sheet lengths. So we know this in glory details from isolated Karen sheet experiments. In this global things, we can, of course, not run like huge aspect ratios. But for our purposes, what's most important is that there are these X points, they energize particles. And in this particular regime where cooling is very efficient, you're not influencing more acceleration events anymore because you gain this energy in the X point. All your energy would be emitted away when you go into the high field region. So you're not able to wait for next X points. So all this business, if you happen to know about island mergers, Fermi acceleration, merging islands, it's not important here because the particle energy don't wait until the secondary events. It's all radiated on the spot. So this is a little bit more zoom in. So these are these overdense regions. You'll see it in the zoom in here. And between this zoomed in overdensities, you find electric field exceeding magnetic field with extended X points where particle energization happens. So this is how the global geometry of the current flow looks like. This this red region is where the current density is highest. So this highlights this undulating current sheet in three dimensions. And you also see that it's not laminar, it's wobbling around. So these are these plasma instabilities which I described before. So this is just summarized what I told in words before. This is how we think the discharge operates. It's all controlled by this quantity, the current divided by the charge density times C. If current is less than the charge density times C, you can provide it with non-relativistic flow of electrons from the surface. So that's it. If the twist of the field lines in this large scale geometry is large, such that it's larger than the charge density times C, you have to provide the discharge. And this is what happens at higher inclinations. At 90 degrees and 60 degrees in certain region of your polar cap, you start to become space-like, your current exceeds the charge density times C, and you drive the discharge. So what happens at this inclination? So what happens at this inclination is that GR effects are important. And how they influence the things is that if you write Maxwell's equations just in a metric which slowly rotates, just taking a first-order Kerr correction, you find that you produce extra electric field by dragging the magnetic field of the star with the space-time. So this is a lens-steering frame dragging velocity, beta, and cross B, it produces you extra electric field. And as I told you before, the divergence of this electric field is the charge density that you need to provide the minimum charge density. So if you just do a very simple calculation, you find that the charge density is decreased. And it's decreased just by the ratio of the lens steering frame dragging to this velocity of the star. So this is just the what we call compactness, 2/5 times the Schwarzschild radius divided by the stellar radius. So this. So this is the charge density. This is the ratio. This is the charge density. Charge density is decreased, but the ratio between the two increases. And instead of the time-like current, you get a space-like current. So this is like a runaway effect. If you're just below the boundary, you get nothing. If you jump ahead, you get everything. So
that number, little omega, bigger omega.
This is 20%. Yeah, this is 20%. But instead of 0.9, you get 1.2. And once you're space-like, you're dead. You cannot do with just electrons with flying outwards.
Especially you're a thunder.
frame dragging, but that is a sub-leading contribution with respect to the potential itself.
No, the electric field from the rotation of the conductor also scales with the velocity of the star. So all these electric fields, they're the same order.
No, I understand, but if I try to think of a Poissonian picture, right? So leading order, I have corrections to the Newtonian potential. And then next to leading order is what Frank Dragon says.
Yeah, the potential, the gravitational field influences on particle trajectories, it's negligible.
So you're ignoring.
Yes, because electromagnetic fields are still much higher than the gravity force. What's important is the dynamics in the electromagnetic field. Just spin, you produce extra spinning of this conducting B field with the space-time.
But if I had the star rotating underneath, if I decoupled the conductor, if I had some conducting surface that was spinning as fast as I want, could I not have like the core just sitting there completely non-spinning? Like most of the metric being set by something with no angular momentum.
Sorry, I didn't quite get it.
So let's say I have a non-spinning neutron star and I rotate on the metric board.
Yeah, then you'll get the Schwarzschild metric, right?
The Schwarzschild metric.
You'll not get any electric field because of the rotation.
But can I not have a conducting surface on that I spin?
I mean, you can, but
and spinning when arbitrarily high with no actual gravitation, you know, I could have zero mass spinning at whatever speed I want.
Yes, the Schwarzschild effect doesn't would not influence things because it would not get a frame dragging.
But this frame dragging is coming from the conducting spinning part, not the actual gravity.
It comes from the mass because it scales with the mass of the star. If you're at zero mass, you're at Schwarzschild, and you don't get this term. This is just proportional to the Schwarzschild radius of the neutron star, which is a mass.
But that's just the radius of which I'm
spinning. No, it's a mass. So at zero mass, you're at Schwarzschild, and this effect is killed. Actually, if you do simulation in Schwarzschild, you're like in a flat space time. There is no difference. All these terms are not important here because they're a second order. The electric field in zeroth order comes just from the rotation of the star. This is second order in the rotation of the star. This is first order. So this you can neglect, and all these corrections are also second order. This is of the first order as well, so you cannot break that. So this was kind of known back in the 90s, but back in the 90s they did not know the large-scale picture of the field. And they were invoking to some different effect that this frame dragging involves. But the real thing is that you just jump from time-like current to space-like, and you cannot survive this charge-separated flow of electrons anymore. So this is actual GR peak simulation of the line rotator. You'll see how the solution develops. This is electrons and positrons. Once the solution is well-established, you create this current circuit system. And if you look into this discharge, how it operates, it starts to become intermittent. So what gives you an intermittency here is that this first electron, which is accelerated, it produces tons of electrons and positrons. They screen the accelerating electric field. And this, the next charge, which is pulled out, cannot be accelerated anymore. So you need to wait before this cloud escape, and this, the next charge would come back and accelerate again. So it's like an intermittent process how this discharge operates. So the influence of this circuit on the polar cap is definitely shown here because in the beginning there was no self-consistent circuit formed, there was not much discharge, but once the whole solution gets established, the current became what it wants and the discharge was producing more actively. So this is definitely important for variability in radio because there are all sorts of time scales at which the radio is important. But what I think drives the radio emission itself is this non-stationary discharge process. So in this non-stationary discharge process, if you look into electromagnetic field, you'll definitely see lots of waves at all scales that reach out. So the physics here is that when this adjustment of electric field in this plasma cloud happens, you naturally produce a tiny fluctuations of current as well. So it a little bit twists and then twists the field as well. So you create both charge and electromagnetic contribution of the wave at once. The question next is how these waves actually propagate, and there is all sorts of business how the radio wave can be absorbed in these plasmas and whatsoever. But I think the glory detail how the mechanism happens is because of this non-stationary discharge happening in the polar cap. And that's actually an important shift of paradigm, because before people were thinking about stationary plasma flow and looking for instabilities in that plasma flow. And they were sorting into all different problems with that. Either instability was not growing fast or was there no instability at all. So the whole assumption of that about stationary flow doesn't exist for sure. There is non-stationary flow that you have to deal with. And I think that they produce this collective oscillations in the field. The frequency, the natural frequencies here are between the plasma frequency scale and the region, the distance before these two subsequent discharges. So the two subsequent discharges happen in between something like a microsecond. This is a typical variability that you see. But the real radius is at a gigahertz, and you need to know the plasma frequency at the point where the actual decoupling of this plasma wave happens. So this is a little uncertain.
Right, so that's what I'm asking. So how do you know that this could be by an explanation for the radio emission and not be manifesting itself, even if it's there onto the different frequency band, have nothing to do with the radio itself?
If you, so the usual logic here is, let's take a phenomenological view for now and say that we kind of know observationally from what distance the radio comes from. If you calculate the plasma frequency at that point, it's in radio range. So this trend of pushing something at plasma frequency was known well before, at some distance from the star. What was not known is how to produce waves. So the waves, I think, are produced by this.
So the thing that limits how stable pulsars are as clocks is that there's this kind of 1 microsecond variability in when the pulses arrive around the SO bottom. Are you saying that it's this instability that's producing that's dominating that variability?
The microsecond, yes, it's the instability which produces subsequent clouds of plasma.
Oh, okay.
There are all sorts of other variabilities coming to seconds, and we even know sources which are on for months and then off for months. So there is a variability on year time scale. I'm not going to address anything about year scale. I cannot think of magnetosphere producing a year time scale. But the variability at, let's say, several rotation times is how this global circuit affects this polar region. The travel time from here to here is a fraction of the rotation. So that's how you can produce other variability, by producing instabilities in this current sheet.
Is there a possible connection between these and what's our region?
Well, the glitches is about the interior, so it doesn't have to do anything with the magnetosphere.
Well, but you're saying the radio is coming, so you're not connecting the radio observations to some particular process here.
Mm-hmm.
And now, yes, I'm going to do something to the pulsar interior, but it has to somehow have an effect on these, so that we see the glitch in the radio.
Yes, I mean, what the glitch does, it influences the rotation rate. So you just change the potential, let's say. It's a zero solder effect. It would be in any model, captured in any model of radio. This is much more detailed than just changing one parameter and see what happens. What's interesting also about these discharges, I'm dragging into more detailed discussion than I wanted, but there is this new satellite, the, how it's called? Anyway of the name, the X-ray timing satellite just came out like last week ago. So what it's going to do is that it's going to time X-ray profiles from these heated portal caps in order to measure the mass of the radius of the neutron star, because the light rays are banded in gravitational field. It allows to measure M over R for a neutron star. And what this physics actually would tell you for that observation is that where you're going to get these heated spots on the polar cap. Because what hits the polar cap is the backflow of charges from this discharge region back to the star. You actually need, I think, to know where these events happen to properly model the light curve. So with more detailed model of this process, we're going to definitely influence the measurements of this sort of kind. So I think it's a very important thing just
is
as now.
Is it possible this accuracy will help us improve the precision of pulsar timing?
Pulsar timing, I think, no. That's, we're gonna match the zeros. So that, yeah, that's too complicated to match. But I'm curious to know how the light curve shapes in X-rays would be different if you, let's say, point a circle on a neutron star, or you point a banana, or the whole like spot on the neutron star. No one did it so far because they didn't, like, people had no idea where you can expect this hitting. You can just point a circle, and that's your best idea so far. So I think that would be interesting. So that's what happens in the uplift geometry. I'm definitely running out of time, and I still have something to say. There is electrons and positrons. Now you're in a steady frame, which someone asked me before, the co-rotating with the pulsar. In that frame, you're quasi-stationary, and that's what you see. Electrons and positrons, they reach a quasi-state picture. And how this instability in the current sheet happens, you can also see. The sheet is initially broad, the field lines come together, and at some point they explode into this instability, which creates the blobs which are living from this white point region. And again, you see the separated blobs coming from the polar cap. This is how the discharge also happens in the oblique geometry.
These are full 3D.
These are full 3D misaligned, GR included, and pair-formation. What's also interesting is that the most energetic particles which leave the pulsar are ions. These ions are extracted at the foot points of this separatrix region between the opened and the closed field light region. They're pulled along the separatrix to the Y point and then to the current sheet. And these are the particles that are tapping most of the potential drop of the neutron star. And on the second hand is that they don't experience much of the radiation losses because they're heavy. Their synchrotron radiation is nothing for them. So they're going to highest energies, going into like tens of percent of this polar cap voltage. And there are most of models about how millisecond magnetars can accelerate ultra-high energy cosmic rays. There are tons of problems of how to get these particles outside from this wind and nebulae. But at least this calculation provides the first principle motivation for that, meaning that we now can constrain to what energies these particles are accelerated, where, and what is the acceleration mechanism. So in the remaining zero smiddens, I'm coming to gamma rays. And the gamma ray modeling is very straightforward, meaning that we have all these complicated three-dimensional models. We need just to go through the particles and calculate the synchrotron light out of these particles. And this is what you get. This gray region is the emission pointing in all directions. And this color thing is the emission which points towards you. And you see two peaks per period usually. And these wiggles on top are small scale plasma instabilities of this current sheet that I told you before. So what's most important is that you do get double peaks from this current sheet. This is what the Fermi observation tell you, that mostly you'll get this double peaks. And typical efficiencies that you get, they depend on inclination angles from, let's say, 1 to 20% you get in gamma rays. And depending also on how efficient this pair creation process is, because the more pairs you produce, the less limited acceleration you get, and less you get in gamma rays. So this is a parameter-dependent number, but its general range is bounded by 120%. The major, actually, quantity in the magnetospheric system, the radio is a noise on top of that, like 10 to minus 6 of the overall energy budget. Gamma rays are the major output from the pulsar, like significant amount of the spin-down luminosity. That's why it's very important to understand them.
Exhibits correlations on relatively large scales, I think associated with the strikes coming out of the modulations coming out, which are reasonably coherent. So does that mean that it's possible to, or is there a strong correlation between the two separate peaks? I mean, you said that the fact that there are two is just geometry. The fact that you see substructure is because of the instability in the outflow. Is the substructure correlated strongly between those two peaks and the consequences of
the this I think we didn't look yet. So the two peaks comes from just that you have this field line which points towards you once per half a period, and then you see a field line from beside the current sheet next time.
Okay.
So it's just geometry. I have a separate slide which explains the geometry. I hidden it if you want that. This shape of the current sheet is a rotating spiral and expanding. And the two effects actually cancel each other. The fact that the spiral rotates and expands, getting that you're actually traveling along radial field line. And you get this emission from the whole field line coming towards you at the same phase. So it's a caustic emission. The whole caustic emits emission which comes at the same time. It's not coherent in the sense that the radio emission is coherent. This is just a geometrical feature that an extended region, just because of the large scale motion, produces an emission coming towards you. So you see this colored thing at like this extended thing. So this rotating monopole, quasi-monopolar fields produce these caustics. So we can quantify all sorts of things, like this is, for example, where these photons are actually produced. In magnetospheres of 30 degrees, many photons are also produced on this separatrix along the boundary of the closed field line region. In 60 degrees, most of them come from outside, from this equatorial current sheet. So there are important differences for different inclination angles. And you can construct light curves for before 40 degrees or 50. Sometimes when you cut the diagram like this, so here this is the rotational phase of the pulsar, this is a viewing angle at which you're looking at the source. If you're looking not at the equator, I'm sorry, if you're looking not at the equator, but at some angle separated from that, sometimes you can get two peaks, but in between them you get some bridge emission. So this is what observed in some pulsars, and then 60 degrees you get just two clean peaks. And these are two examples from Fermi, like sometimes there are two separated peaks, sometimes there is bridge emission with an asymmetry between the peaks. So this is the general features that our models definitely reproduce. You can also calculate the spectra. So what's interesting here is that because of this breaking symmetry, because the magnetic moment has a particular orientation with respect to the rotation axis, there is a peculiar, specific sign of charge which actually is accelerated to highest energies. And if you're semi-aligned, the electric field direction wants to accelerate more of positrons. So this is the emission flux from positrons, this is the emission flux from electrons, and this is the combined. So to highest energies, it accelerates positrons, and the gamma rays are usually dominated by this positronic contribution. So the spectra is usually either flat in these coordinates or increasing, and then there is an exponential cutoff. So this is a typical data from Fermi that you see. There is a rising part and then the fall off. And we are working into understanding what actually sets the cutoff. So it turns out that it's quite simple. It's just a magnetic field where you put a particle times the typical energy squared that you get. This is typical synchrotron radiation. But what actually regulates the energy that that the particle can gain depends on the pair production in the current sheet. So this is for carefully modeling that you need taking into account this non-local two-photon collisions accurately. So we're now doing like isolated simulations of the current sheet, which will tell you how many particles you actually produce in these current sheets, in order to provide a robust prediction for this sigma parameter. Because for sigma parameter, you need to know the density of the particles in the sheet. I think I should wrap up. I have a model for giant pulses, but I think I don't have time. I'll just finish here, I think. Oh. Something bad happened with the computer. Okay, so these are my conclusions. I think that we can now go into details of how the pulsar emission mechanism is produced for the first time from 67, and this numerical full-scale kinetic simulations allowed us to do this. The general relativity turned out to be important for operation of pulsars. We now know that gamma rays are likely be produced via synchrotron mechanism. more work needs to be done into understanding how this non-stationary discharge produces radio waves. But I think it's a very favorable candidate for that. And these energetic ions from pulsars, I think, is very interesting for modeling ultra-high energy cosmic rays. Thanks.
Kind of related to that last point. So do we understand pulsars enough now with this work and others' work to completely explain, you know, all the data from Fermi and, you know, like
yes,
10
yes.
years ago, this Camella thing that people thought was dark matter, and then other people came and said, oh, no, that's pulsars.
Yes.
I mean, is the evolution of the understanding enough now that we really can say definitively,
yes,
all these things we observe are pulsars and not dark matter, say, or something else?
I think we should not say now that pulsars are something that can produce whatever you want.
Okay.
Definitely.
But is it constraining enough to make, is it?
I think for something like Pamela, like just the general consideration, fine. You don't, at certain energies, you can expect more details from those models. But overall, I don't think the picture was very constraining. The ultra high energy cosmic rays, you need to do model about how the ions propagate out from this nebulae. Other people are doing this, so I'm thinking like, I'm the guy who would produce in the input. I know the spectrum, I know where they're coming from.
Is there any sense in which these current sheets evolve as the pulsars get older and their magnetic fields die out of it?
Right, so when the pulsar dies, the voltages become lower, and at some point your current sheet is not able anymore to produce secondary pairs. You need to supply it only from the surface of the star. So our models are not yet showing that you have a well active model in that parameter regime. But I think this is where separation of scales actually becomes important. To model this return current layers, turned out you need to get as more and more separation of scales to produce a reasonable discharge. So my most recent calculations show that they do work, but they are much more intermittent. So these nulling sources near the death line of pulsars, where they're mostly dead, they should be much more intermittent, because the whole circuit would be on and on all the time. Much less stable than those that I showed you now.
Because that kind of speaks to this question, because until we really know what A we expect the sheets to sort of shut off.
Yes, I think
the actual global.
I mean, for gamma rays, we know the death line in gamma rays. I think that's mostly where the active current sheet with producing the secondary pairs dies. There can be still current sheet at lower voltages, but it would be much less active. Would accelerate much less than the current sheet in the young pulsar.
So, quick one. So let me come back to my question about GR, because there is a scale that you told us later on in the talk that does matter, which is the compaction. So how do you reconcile that with the artificial hierarchy of scales?
I mean, compaction divided by the radius of the star, what's important, so the ratio.
Right.
I mean, you can the range that you can find is from what, like 0.5 to 0.3. It's like, for this purposes, you can say it's 0.5 and that's it. The Schwarzschild radius is twice smaller than the radius of the star. That's what we use. It cannot be order of magnitude less for a neutron star. So it's a fraction of the stellar radius. I think it's fine.
Okay, so Sash is here till tomorrow.
3:30.
And we're about to go to lunch.
Yeah.
Anyone who's welcome to join us.
Lovely, thank you again.
Okay.